Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Delighted to have Dr. Asher Weiner, a doctor in private practice at Ophthalmic Consultants of the Capital Region in Troy, Albany, Clifton Park, and Scodak, New York, which provides the latest in technology and treatment for conditions such as diabetic eye diseases, macular degeneration, cataracts, glaucoma, dry eye injuries, and LASIK. You can find more information at www.ophthalmicconsultants.com. Dr. Weiner's previous positions include Clinical Associate Professor, Eye Research Institute, Oakland University, and William Beaumont Hospital, Michigan, where he was a glaucoma attending surgeon, William Beaumont Hospital, Royal Oak, Michigan, among other hospitals, and Director of Ophthalmology Services and University Ophthalmic Consulting, PC, Glaucoma Service, Long Island College Hospital, SUNY Downstate, Brooklyn, New York. Welcome, Dr. Weiner. So, I guess I got to ask you, who are you? Who made you what you are? Where were you born? Tell us a little bit about your personal background.
Well, first, Alan, thanks for inviting me. There are important glaucoma messages that I want to convey to the community, and thanks for inviting me. Who am I? Well, I was born in Israel many years ago, grew up there, and went to medical school at the Hebrew University and Hadassah Medical School in Jerusalem. I did my ophthalmology residency training there, then came to Boston to do an extra training, fellowship training in retinal dystrophy at the Massachusetts Eye and Ear Infirmary, Harvard Medical School. I knew Boston from before because I was an exchange student already in high school, and I spent 6 months in the Boston area going to high school, so I got to know the area as well. Went back to Israel, was on staff at Hadassah in Jerusalem, then decided to move to the States, repeated my training, including internship at Henry Ford Hospital in Michigan.
Did you have to do that? In other words, so if you were trained in Israel, you don't automatically get recognized in the United States in terms of your degrees?
I do get recognized for medical school. The medical school at Hadassah in Jerusalem is one of the best known actually throughout the world, but I had to, of course, take some exams to be certified here in the U.S. as a medical doctor. But in order to become certified or a diplomat of the American Academy of Ophthalmology, then I had to repeat my ophthalmology residency in the States, and I've done that in Cleveland while being engaged in several research projects. And then I went again to yet another fellowship training in glaucoma surgery, and specifically at the Wills Eye Hospital in Philadelphia, again, one of the best institutions, among others, for glaucoma training.
So tell me about Israel. When you were growing up, which community were you in?
I grew up in Tel Aviv, born in Tel Aviv, basically spent my youth there except the exchange program in Boston, joined the army service like everybody else.
And I was going to ask you about that. Tell me about the army. What was that like?
Well, obviously there aren't that many things I can tell you, but...
Is that right? I mean, there's still things that one cannot say about one's army service in Israel.
Of course. Specifically, especially where you are serving and so on, what branch and so on. But
were you doing doctor stuff? No.
I was doing the real stuff. But then after the 3 years, I went to the medical school at Hadassah. Then you are on the reserve, so every year you actually get to do doctor stuff once you get extra training for that.
Uh-huh. How committed are people in Israel to doing that service?
Very committed. We grow up with the deep understanding of what it means to be threatened on a daily basis. You grow up committed to serving. Unfortunately, we have the very, very strong background of the Holocaust. My family alone lost most of its members being murdered by the Nazis. So you grow up under this cloud or intense kind of environment, and you know that when the time comes, you go to the army and you protect your family, because if you don't, nobody else does.
And how did that Holocaust survivorship, you know, the second generation, how did that personally affect you?
Well, it's very hard to tell because you have to be very objective, and you can't really be objective when you are under that environment. But it's something that you live with every single day of your life from day one. You know, you always remember the family members you never got to meet. I never had a grandfather. I never had a grandmother. Many, many aunts and uncles I never had. I knew they were one day in the past. They have been there, but I never got to meet them.
How did your parents get to Israel, considering everything that had happened?
Well, my mom is a survivor. She was sent to several camps, among them the famous or infamous Auschwitz camp. Most of the family were extinct. She was, I don't know if you can say it, lucky to survive by becoming... The Nazis actually made her a slave in one of their airplane manufacturing factories that were in an old underground salt mine, and they had to live like this and work like this, probably close to a year, and... You know, you never see the sunlight. You just work on the in this kind of salty environment. She barely survived. She made it through the end of the world.
When you say she barely survived, what does that mean?
Well, she almost didn't make it. I mean, they were basically walking skeletons at the time. She was taken by the Red Cross to Sweden to a kind of rehab camp to try to put her back on her feet. She literally could not even walk anymore.
Does she remember her release? Does she remember the day it happened?
Of course, absolutely. But it's so hard for her to talk about it. Thankfully, she's still alive and still in Israel. And
how old is she, Usher?
Well, actually, her birthday is coming up on Monday, and she's going to be 86 up there. And she has all the ailments and the pains, things involved, and I'm sure it's affected by her history. And but, you know, she's a very strong woman. She made it. She survived. And her greater revenge was to have a family and kids.
And your father?
My father is a little different history. He was born in Riga, Latvia. He was a Zionist to begin with. He escaped from home when he was basically a late teenager. He was part of Beitar, which is a right movement that believed in the establishment of the State of Israel. He ran away before the Nazis went in. He took him about a year in all kinds of illegal ways to arrive to Israel. And then he joined the underground and joined Begin. He was one of his people. Sure. And worked with him and made it through.
Did they talk to you coming up about this, or were they reticent to do that?
Very little. Usually they were very reluctant to talk about it. I would have to milk information from them and others. Most of the information I got was from kind of around them, from other people, from history, from reading. They're very reluctant to talk about it. My father passed away a few years ago. My mom is still reluctant, although she did write something, and we are trying to encourage her to write more. But it's very difficult for them to this day.
So in terms of your career choices and what you've done, were they anxious to see you have this full education ending up in being a doctor?
Absolutely. It was, I guess, part of the revenge and part of that every Jewish parent wants to see their son's doctor or something else. It's part of the recovery, part of the being on their feet all over again through perhaps somebody else. They went through all that. They funded all my studying, and they made sure that I got there.
How do they do that? Where'd the money come from?
By not buying stuff, by not not eating too extravagantly, by saving a penny to penny, and they made it happen.
Wow. And what did they do for a living?
My mom really was at home once we kids were born.
How many were there? How many kids were
there? My sister and myself. And my father worked very hard in the agriculture ministry in Israel and worked morning to evening, kind of what we do.
You seem like a stoic fellow. To what degree does that stoicism come? I mean, you're tough. To what degree, or you appear to be, to what degree does that come from what you faced in your life up to now?
I think that everything in my life came from that. There's no way to separate. I think that if my parents were not, my mom was not a survivor, then I would be probably a very different person today. There's no question in my mind.
Mm-hmm. How much of it is related, do you think, I don't know if you've thought about this a lot, but I'm sure you have, to the Holocaust issues, and how much just to being an Israeli?
Everything has to do with it. From day one, you are born, you always feel guilty that you are the one that is alive. And
do you?
The family, of course. I mean, this is the second generation phenomenon. I don't think it's something deliberately done by the survivors, but they convey to you that you are the luckiest person on earth to just be able to breathe. And yes, you have to be tough because everything that you suffer is nothing in comparison to what other people have suffered. You grow up in that environment, plus the fact that you're threatened by Israel neighbors, I mean the Arab countries around Israel, every single day. And you live in war times as a kid. You know, I remember the sirens when I was 10 years old in a 67 war in my elementary school, and then you run to shelter. And you go through that war after war after war after war. So this is your life.
Before we get to glaucoma, I want to ask you a question. Is man inherently evil?
Wow. That's a very, very tough question. I've been struggling with this forever, and I think that part of the way I deal with things is that in the back of my mind, there is that thought that maybe that's the case. Mm-hmm. So it's really tough to deal with it and yet commit yourself to basically the opposite, which means to heal, to prevent blindness to make sure that nobody loses vision. It's very tough when you always contemplate the thought, well, under other circumstances, is it possible that that person that I'm treating actually is evil? It's very, very hard to deal with.
When people criticize Israel, which of course we both know, we're both Jewish, we both know it happens, do you ever just want to scream, you don't understand?
Just about twice a day.
Yeah.
Every single day, of course.
What don't they understand?
Well, see, many people around the world, especially in the U.S., are very, very, very lucky because they grow up in a very sheltered environment. And of course, there are those terrible incidents we hear about all the time, you know, school shooting and all that. But overall, people are extremely sheltered here. They don't know what it means to live under fire, to live under rockets. Some Israeli cities are under that every single day for years. And, you know, sometimes you want to scream and you say, well, you know, if New Jersey were under rockets every single day, you can imagine what the U.S. government would do. If rockets would come from Mexico, you know what the government would do. But in Israel, Israel is supposed to kind of sit tight, sustain it, live under it, and understand that, well, that's life and you just have to live through that. So, of course, it's very frustrating.
Asher Weiner, I guess I wanted to ask you, why did you choose the United States over Israel?
I think one of the main issues were when I went to Boston for my training at Harvard, at the Massachusetts Eye and Ear Infirmary, while I was still in training in Israel, doing my residency in ophthalmology there. And I just was amazed as to how advanced we could be the things that we can develop for the sake of human beings. It's really as simple as that. And I felt that after I went back to Israel, that was was a crucial thing for me to live in an environment where I could do that. So that really pushed me forward. I started understanding what research was when I was there. I spent 2 years there doing a lot of clinical and research projects, and I felt that this would be the best environment for me to develop into something that I can do for other people.
Some 40 years ago, I spent some time in Israel with my wife, and everybody I met said, you belong here, you don't belong in the States. What happened in Germany will happen in the States. And I remember that debate. I don't think we see it as much anymore. What do you think? You think that this country could face what the Nazis did in Germany?
That's a very complex question, but the answer is actually very blunt. The answer is yes, because it can happen anywhere. Humans are humans, and under the wrong circumstances, you know, bad economy, under great stress, people change. Maybe they expose what's inside. Maybe they change to something else in order to survive. It's very easy to slip into that kind of superiority feeling. We see that in many places, including in the U.S., we all are aware of those experiments where kids were turned into fascists by design. I'm sure you remember those experiments at schools. And that was a very clear message that, yes, absolutely, it can happen. And you always have to live on your guard. And from my background, I know that it can happen.
Do you think young Germans have changed?
Yes, but I think things can change very quickly. For example, when I was... We were living in Michigan, and we had friends, Germans, and I'm not sure what their background was and what their parents were involved in, but we were always welcoming them, and they were in our house. And one day for a dinner, the gentleman, the husband, was making very interesting jokes about Jews and crematoriums. And I was just sitting there in shock, sitting in front of him. He knew my background, and yet... He was so, I don't know how to describe it, was so not understanding where he was. And this was, of course, the last time we ever invited him to our home. So things can happen very quickly, I think, and can get very ugly. And people are not always with the best judgment or the best character, and things can happen very fast.
So there was the Zionist enclave known as Israel. There are those who say that the human rights of Arabs are not respected in Israel. What do you think?
Anytime you live in an environment where people want to do you harm, you have to take measures to protect yourself. And sometimes other people, innocent people, would pay a price. For example, I just on the way here today, I heard on the radio how the Pakistani prime minister is here. And there was just more information about drones killing civilians in Pakistan, American drones. We know we don't want to do that. We know we don't want to hurt civilians and innocent people. But when the bad guys hide among the innocent, then innocent get hurt. And this is kind of what is happening in Israel. The bad guys indeed hide among the innocent. That's one of their strategies. And you have to hit them hard or you get killed. And, you know, we got killed so much, enough is enough. So we have to fight back. We will not take sitting down what happened to us in the past. And yes, innocent people pay a price. It's unfortunate. It's terrible. But what else can you do? So yes, rights are being crushed sometimes and people get hurt and they're not treated well. And nobody likes to sit for 2 hours in a checkpoint to be searched. There's no question. I mean, it's bad, but the solution is not easing up on there. The solution is just get a final solution, be it a two-state solution or whatever you want to decide is the best for everybody around, and then it'll stop.
Dr. Weiner, I love the fact that you've spent a little time with us on that, and I think it helps explain a lot about who you are, and I appreciate that. Let's go to medicine. Why ophthalmic research?
Well, actually, the whole thing started because I was watching my father for years with glaucoma. And he was...
Okay, let me stop you right there. Okay. What's glaucoma?
All right. Well, that's a very interesting question. It's a very simple question, but the answer is very complex, and it appears to be changing every several years. For example, when I was in training many, many years ago, we were taught that, well, if the eye pressure, the pressure inside the eye is above 21, then it's glaucoma. And if the pressure is below 21, no, then it's not glaucoma, which was an extremely simplistic way of looking at things. And I'm glad that we have learned much, much more since then and know that it's just not correct. But that was the definition then.
And then that wasn't that long ago.
No, I mean, like 200 years ago. I'm kidding. But yes, it was not that many years ago, and things have changed very, very quickly and drastically. And I'm glad because we understand much more today and how to treat it and how to diagnose it. Today, I would say that the simplest definition would be that this is a disease of the optic nerves. The optic nerve is what connects your eye to the brain, sort of what connects your TV to your cable station. All the images come from the eye, and they have to go through that cable, the optic nerve, to the brain to be translated and to be recognized, and that's vision. Glaucoma is where this optic nerve is slowly gets destroyed. It happens slowly, but you see, there are many, many types of glaucoma. People think glaucoma is one disease. It's actually probably more than 40 types by now that we know, and some of them are acute. You can all of a sudden wake up one morning and find that, boy, something is wrong. There's pain, there's redness, I'm losing vision, something is happening. That's the acute form, but that's the much less common than the chronic insidious way that glaucoma progresses. And there is the problem, because this condition, usually the chronic glaucoma, is such a it's a sneaky condition because it advances very slowly. The patient doesn't realize what's going on. Patient is losing vision, yet they still don't recognize it because we adapt. Our brain adapts all the time. And if something happens slowly, then, well, maybe that's normal and you don't really notice what's going on until one day you are shocked because somebody either finds that you have glaucoma and that it was allowed to progress for way too long, or you already feel that something is wrong and you lost most of your vision, then the doctor tells you, yep, I wish we diagnosed it 20 years ago, we could have saved your vision.
I want to ask you about that. I've been going to eye doctors for a long, long time, and they always sort of do what they do, and they always check for glaucoma. Have they been missing something all these years because of these various types of glaucoma?
Look, again,
that is so Israeli. I love it. They say, look, come on.
Well, it gives you a chance to think. That's what it is. But the reason I'm hesitating is not because I've never thought about this question, but
no,
because the answer is very, that's right, it's very, very delicate. And I'll try to be very careful in what I'm saying. There are different ways of trying to detect and diagnose glaucoma. And the most common way till today is have your pressure check. They call it the glaucoma test. And I'm sure that, you know, you go somewhere and you get puffed and with that machine trying to check your pressure.
That thing actually touches your eye, doesn't it?
It's a fast stream of air that kind of indents on your cornea. So, yes, it does. But it's the air puff that touches your eye in that particular test. It's not the most reliable method of measuring the eye pressure. And not only that, but then you're being told, oh, your pressure is fine, you don't have glaucoma, go home, come back in a year.
Yeah. What is the more reliable way?
Well, we use the applanation tonometry, which actually does touch your eye. It's considered the golden standard of pressure check. But even today, there are people that question even that, and maybe there are more reliable methods because it's affected by many factors, and we can talk about it later on. But see, it's not the biggest issue because the pressure is just a risk factor, and that's what we learned over these years, that the disease is not the pressure. You can have above normal eye pressure and never have glaucoma. And you can have normal pressure and still have glaucoma. So when somebody considers the pressure check as the glaucoma test, they are deceiving you, not intentionally, but because they just don't know enough about glaucoma. Glaucoma detection has to do with examination of the optic nerve. This is really where the problem is.
Can we do that? Can we actually see the optic nerve?
Of course. First of all, you look through the pupil and you see the inside of the eye. Yes, you are using. We are using special instruments for that, but it's very commonplace. Everybody has it, I hope. And
what does the optic nerve look like?
From the inside of the eye, as we look into, it actually looks like a little donut. It has the what we call the neural rim, the nerve fibers around, which is the donut, and then it has the hole in the middle, which is not really a hole, but an opening where blood vessels come in and so on. People used to look at the hole of the donut instead of looking at the donut itself, which is the nerve tissue. And you don't want to lose that nerve tissue because that's where your vision is running through. And that's what glaucoma does. It takes away those neural fibers. So you have to examine that neural rim, as we call it, the donut itself. It doesn't matter how big the hole is in the middle, but it does matter how thick and healthy the nerve rim is all around. So it's a little donut that we pay a lot of attention to.
But just to be clear, the optic nerve, which is so important in terms of this diagnosis, but there are other diseases of the optic nerve that are not glaucoma, right?
Absolutely. And there are many kinds, inflammatory and ischemic, based on bad blood supply and other conditions, drugs can do that. There are many things that can affect the optic nerves. And there is another...
Which drugs can do that?
Anything as common as alcohol.
Really?
And malnutrition because of alcoholism. And there are many, many conditions, also congenital. You may be born with a condition that kind of strikes you later on in life.
If your parents had it, are you more likely to have it?
You're talking about glaucoma?
Yes.
Family history is a strong risk factor, but it does not necessarily mean that you will get glaucoma if, say, your mom had glaucoma. No, but it is a risk factor, and we have to always take that into account, especially if siblings, for example, are affected, maybe even more so than parents. But it does tell you that there's something genetic running in your family that you really should be very careful and look out for that.
Have we been able to start to isolate the genes that lead to this?
Yes, especially the juvenile kind, the congenital kind, also maybe some in the adult, which is the much more common type. But there are still many, many genes that we have not discovered, and it's still not a practical method. In other words, if you walked into my office, I still don't have a genetic blood test sending your DNA and coming back with a result. Yeah, you have glaucoma or not, that is still not practical today.
So what are the other risk factors? Is diabetes one?
Diabetes, yes, although there was some debate about it some years ago with the results of one large study, but it is considered to be a risk factor. Age, of course, is, although you can get glaucoma throughout your life from being born with it, having congenital glaucoma, juvenile glaucoma, you can develop later on in your teens and 20s, and of course the adult chronic type, and there are, again, there are many, many types, don't forget that.
Mm-hmm. So when somebody walks into your office, Dr. Weiner, can you take a fast look and say, uh-oh?
Yeah, you can actually do that, but in advanced glaucoma. I might be walking into a room and somebody is sitting in the chair and I see them for the first time, and just the way they look at me or try to look at me from across the room, I can already tell that there's something really, really wrong sitting there. But in most cases, no. In most cases, it requires a tremendous amount of work and workup and examinations and tests in order to make the correct diagnosis and to know what to do.
You're a specialist in glaucoma. Other things, too, but you specialize in glaucoma. You've done a lot of research. What's that research look like?
Well, there are two kinds of research that I've been engaged in. One is electrophysiology, meaning the recording of function. Just like EKG for the heart, we can do a lot of recordings of function in the eye, both from the optic nerve as well as from the retina. But in the past,
I'm sorry for being stupid, but I want to ask you for a couple of definitions of retina, cornea, just so that everybody who's listening is on first base together.
Sure.
What are these things?
The cornea is the front of the eye, the window. It's a transparent tissue through which we see things. Behind that is the anterior chamber full of fluid.
What does the cornea do? I mean, does it...
First of all, it's the wall of the eye. The eye has to be closed. So
yes.
This is the wall of the eye, but it's specialized into being a transparent tissue so you can look through it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all it does. It just maintains the integrity of the eye and retains itself transparent.
Is it also sort of like a eyeglass in that some corneas magnify at different places than others?
Absolutely. The curvature of the cornea actually is the strongest refractive power of the eye. In other words, most of the way we concentrate the light from the outside, from the objects, onto the retina, which is the film in the camera basically, comes through the cornea and being diverted by the cornea. And then behind that, you have the pupil and then the lens behind it, which is, when the lens goes bad, it becomes a cataract. And the back of the eye is the retina.
Not so fast. The cataracts, I've had my cataracts removed in that time. That is, what is that second level again? The front level is the cornea, then comes the...
Well, behind it is the anterior chamber, which is a space filled with fluid. And then the iris, the color part, and the pupil.
Yes.
And right behind it sits the lens.
Okay.
Then your natural lens is suspended by little things going around 360 degrees called the zonules. And
zonules?
Zonules is the little structures like little fine hair, many, many, many of them holding the lens suspended. The lens is actually not attached to tissue but suspended by those zonules so that it can move. It can become thinner and thicker to give you the ability to zoom in and out, if you will.
Now, I've heard about corneal transplants, right?
Mm-hmm.
Have I ever heard about lens transplants?
Well, the cataract surgery is where we remove the cataract, the lens, your lens that has gone bad, and put a new lens in there. So it's not a transplant because it's an artificial thing, but it's a new lens that we put in the eye instead of your cataract.
Now, once the optic nerve goes bad, I have a friend who really did suffer from that. Just woke up one morning and didn't see out of one eye and a third of the other eye. And you guys were great with him. But is there any way we can repair the optic nerve?
Well, let's start with the future. The future, hopefully, is that with maybe one day stem cells, you can grow the optic nerve, but there's still a lot of research to be done.
But how would that work, theoretically?
Well, it's very tough to answer that, but I can just imagine that we have your stem cells and we inject them into the optic nerve once it has been severely injured. And the idea is that the stem cells will know where they are and by sensing different factors around them and start growing nerve tissue or nerve fibers that will reconnect and become a new optic nerve. This is, in theory, I think it's, I can imagine it's possible, but it's going to take a lot of work.
Any animal testing yet?
There's a lot of animal testing. They're doing experiments as to injuring the optic nerves and seeing how to allow them to recover and survive. I'm sure there are studies about stem cells as well, but I don't think we are anywhere near.
So we started with a very simple question. I thought, what is glaucoma? And you started to talk about, 36 or something like that, different varieties of it. And the word pressure was used. But then you sort of, if I'm listening carefully enough, you destroyed that saying, it's much more than just pressure. Is that right?
That's correct. We know that the pressure is just
a
risk factor.
Yep.
It's just a risk factor. Again, you can have normal pressure with glaucoma. You can have high pressure without glaucoma. The higher the pressure, the higher the risk to convert to glaucoma in the future. And in some acute glaucomas, it's because there's very, very high pressure. You have a drainage system in your eye. If that all of a sudden gets blocked by something, the pressure builds up quickly because the fluid in the eye has nowhere to go, cannot be drained. And that high pressure alone can destroy the optic nerves, sometimes within days and hours. But in general, with a chronic type of glaucoma, the pressure is just another risk factor. The pressure is also what we treat. And that is as of today, it's the most effective means of stabilizing the glaucoma.
And you do that how?
Well, first of all, there's no cure for glaucoma as of yet. And so we can only treat the lowering the eye pressure in order to stabilize the glaucoma, and we are able to do that. We're actually pretty good at doing that.
How?
We use different means. We use medications, eye drops. We can talk a lot about that. We can use laser treatments that in some ways become more and more a first-line treatment these days. And, of course, surgery.
Well, how can a laser decrease pressure?
Well, we're talking about something called trabeculoplasty, which means kind of modifying the trabecular meshwork, which is actually the drain of the eye. So,
could you go over those two words with me a little bit slower?
Sure. The trabecular meshwork is just a scientific name of what we call the drain or the sink in your eye. Again, like everything in medicine and in eyes in particular, it's much more complex than we describe, but let's just leave it at that. The laser that we do is called, specific laser that, for example, I'm using in the office is called selective laser trabeculoplasty, which really means that with a laser, we modify the drain. We sort of think of it as unclogging it. Think of it as making the cells that are responsible for the drainage to work better and to clear the debris that is clogging the drain, make them more efficient in the transfer of the fluid from the eye to the drain, and thereby the drainage system is working better. So we do that. But you see, it's a very, and also the third option, as I mentioned before, is surgery, and we do a lot of that.
Well, I think everybody's listening is going to want to know the answers to this. I'm sorry for being so persistent, but if you do surgery, what do you do?
Well, there are different kinds of surgeries. Either we do the what we call the minimally invasive glaucoma surgery that we do a lot these days, which means that we, in different ways, open new drainage channels inside your eye. Most of them, the one that I do, for example, a lot, is opening the drain itself. Think of it as removing the strainer from the sink. It's called trabectome, and we do a lot of that. And we are very good at doing that, but everything has to be indicated in the right condition. For example, I wouldn't do it for very, very advanced glaucoma. I would do it for those who are highly suspect for glaucoma or have early to moderate glaucoma. Then when you have more aggressive glaucoma or you have lost more vision from glaucoma, then we would go to more aggressive surgery, which is creating a whole new drain for the eye. In a way, we are giving up on your drain and we give you a new one.
How do you do it?
Well, something called, for example, trabeculectomy is a procedure where I use the tissues of the eye under the coats of the eye to create a new drain for the eye in a guarded manner so that it doesn't drain too much, it doesn't drain too little. If that doesn't work, or you can go to another option, which is a tube shunt implantation, which is basically a whole new plumbing system for the eye. You know, we are plumbers after all. So we...
You mean doctors who take something out?
Glaucoma
something
doctors.
In. Yes.
Glaucoma
or other doctors, heart doctors too, right?
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
So the tube shunt implantation would be a silicone-made implantation of a whole new plumbing system for the eye. And again, there's a very certain way of doing it to keep the eye safe.
Now, we must be talking about very little things here, right? I mean, we're not talking about, you know, when you say it's a shunt in the heart, you know, in the vein, you know, it could be a fairly substantial thing. But when you're talking about the eye, which is a very small thing, then how big are these innovations?
Usually we're talking about millimeters in size, and we do all our surgeries under the microscope.
How does that work? You have a big sort of screen, in it, especially the minimally invasive?
No, I sit in front of the bed of the patient, and I actually don't look at the patient during surgery. I mean, I look straight ahead into a microscope, and the microscope shows me what's underneath, and my hands are underneath. So, of course, it does require a little bit of coordination, I would say.
You say your hands are underneath. Underneath what?
Underneath the microscope, in the eye or over the eye.
Uh-huh.
You're looking straight ahead into the microscope, so you have to learn, and that's what we do in
hand-eye coordination
training. Absolutely.
Did you play a lot of skill games as a kid do, which demand hand-eye coordination?
Not more than other people.
So when you say minimally invasive, you know, I had back surgeries, minimally invasive. The guy's hands never go in your back. How does that work? Do you use robotic arms or what?
No, although there are attempts to develop that, but we are certainly not there. And even in other subjects, if you read carefully about it, you may find that the robotic doesn't always mean better.
Yeah.
But in eyes, no, we are still not there, certainly not there. We are hands-on. When I say minimally invasive, it means that instead of doing aggressive surgery as creating a whole new drain for the eye, if I go in and just make an opening inside the drain, inside the eye, We call that minimally invasive because it's done through a very small incision, maybe 1.7 millimeter only.
How big is a millimeter?
How big is a millimeter? 1/10 of a centimeter.
And how big is a centimeter? Is that? I mean, I'm always trying to give people an idea of what we're talking about.
Well, 1 inch is, say, 2.5 centimeters.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So you're talking about 1 millimeter, which is 1/10 of 1 centimeter, and you have 2.5 of those centimeters in 1 inch. So
we're
it's
talking
really
pretty
small.
Tiny.
We are.
Does it matter whether you have thin hands or fat hands?
No. What matters is that you know what to do with your hands and you have steady hands and you know how to support them and to be very steady and know exactly what you're doing.
Right. How many people does it take to do an operation like this? You know, we're used to the old Dr. Kildare movies where the surgeon is standing there, there are 14 people standing around him. What could we envision when you're doing eye surgery?
No, these days are gone because we don't like infections. And we don't like crowds of people in your OR. You want to keep your operating room as sterile and clean as possible. So
do you do it in the office or do you have to do it in the hospital?
No, we do it in an eye surgery center. It happens to be in Latham. And it's dedicated space for sterile environment. There's one surgeon who is scrubbed and sterile, of course. There is the assistant, the technician who helps the surgeon, and there are one or two nurses in the room to get stuff that we need because the other two are scrubbed and sterile.
Uh-huh.
So we're talking about 3-4 people in the room at the time.
Well, how expensive is this?
Very expensive. I mean,
is this an issue?
Absolutely, it is an issue. And the issue of cost, it's interesting that you mention it because it goes, it's not only in surgery because everything is expensive, because every little thing that you pick up costs a lot of money. Every needle that you use, every machine that you use, every disposable and a knife or whatever that you want to use is extremely expensive, unfortunately. And it makes things very expensive. But it goes all the way to eye drops. I mean, people would like to think, well, I have glaucoma, I'm going to use this drop, I'm going to be fine. But guess what? We know more and more that that doesn't work very well.
So you have to compound for individuals?
You mean the medications?
Yes.
Some of them are, but most are not. Most are manufactured and they are shipped to us, to the patient, in a bottle, and they use it. It does not have to be compounded in what we hear compounded pharmacies. No, that doesn't usually work. Some medications, yes.
Okay, so it's expensive to do this. Medicare pay for everything?
For those that are eligible, they cover, I believe, 80% of the expense, and then hopefully the patient has a supplemental insurance covering the rest of the 20%. And of course, when it comes to commercial insurance companies, when you're not eligible to Medicare, then they hopefully cover most, if not all, of the expense.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that your firm has to fight for patients to get them what they deserve with insurance companies?
Absolutely. That's actually becoming worse and worse. That's one of the problems of using eye drops. See, there's so many issues. We can start with non-compliance. Let's start with the patient. Patients are humans, and humans are not very good in adhering to a regimen. And if you tell them that you need to use this drop once a day or twice a day or three times a day, very quickly it goes downhill. First of all, they may not use it to begin with. Secondly, they may have a hard time getting the medication into the eye. It's hard to put an eye drop correctly.
You bet.
I've done it.
I try to do it.
Yeah. It's very
and
hard.
I always think I've missed.
And I bet you did because it's very easy to do so.
You can blink.
And then you waste drops. And if you waste drops, then you run out of drops. Then you go to the pharmacy. The pharmacy tells you, what, you're not eligible. It's not. You shouldn't be out of the drop. So the insurance won't cover your next bottle. So now you run out of medication and you have to wait until the insurance gives you the medication or you pay out of pocket. Well, guess what? It's expensive. It's very expensive. Then we went to generics. So we are trying to use more generics, and the companies are pushing generics. And guess what? Recently, we have a crisis where some generics cost more than brand names. Somebody is making profit on all this. Then you have all the side effects from eye drops. You can get allergies. You can get effects on your breathing, on your blood pressure. Eye drops are not something that is very innocent. Many people say, well, I'm afraid of a procedure. I want to do the eye drops. But guess what? I had patients ending up in a hospital from eye drops. Never from a procedure, never from a laser or a surgery. So people's concept of how easy eye drops are is just wrong.
So you must have to retrain a lot. I mean, how old are you now? Am I allowed to ask?
In my 50s.
Okay, in your 50s. But you're on cutting edge here, and every day somebody's going to invent something else, and you got to go back and retrain, right?
That's true. And just like the minimally invasive, the trabectum procedure, yeah, we trained some years ago.
How do you do
ago.
That? I mean, how do you find out you need to do it, and then where do you go to do it?
Well, first of all, you always have to be careful in what you do. You don't jump to any new technology just because some company starts pushing it on you.
Sure.
You don't do that. You resist that. And you sit back and you look at the data and you find out all the research information. You make sure that the research is genuine. It's not maybe biased by some people or the company. You got to be very careful these days, unfortunately. Then you have to be assured that the safety is there. And when you start doing a new procedure on a patient, on your patient, you better be sure that you're doing something that is really safe. Everything has risks. There's no question about it. It's always an issue to weigh the risks of doing something versus the risks of not doing something or the risks of doing something else instead. So once you come to the conclusion that, yes, this can really help a certain group of my patients, again, nothing fits all. You have to also choose who is the right person to have it on. Once you determine that and you feel that this is a good new technology to learn and to apply to some of your patients, then you do that. You take a course. There are many national meetings like the American Academy of Ophthalmology. All kinds of courses are being offered.
And well, when you say a course, do you get the hands-on experience at that
yes.
course?
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
You hear a lot of information about it, and then you have like a wet lab, something that you actually try to do it. And since you are already a surgeon, you have a lot of experience. You can adapt very quickly. But there are always nuances that you really want to learn.
I'm sorry to push you on this, but don't the young guys have a big advantage because, you know, they come out, they've now learned with the newest technology, and everybody else has got to go figure out how to get it done?
No, actually, it's the opposite.
Okay.
Because we adapt to new technologies, and because we know we are experienced, we can adapt very quickly and do it right. The young kids coming out of training, unfortunately, are not familiar with the old techniques.
Mm-hmm.
And guess what? Sometimes in the OR, something happens and you need to resort to the old technique to do it right. Unfortunately, the young kids don't necessarily know that. They have to learn that. For example, let's take something as simple as suturing. We do a lot of suturing inside the eye or outside the eye.
If it's so especially, things up. Yeah.
Yeah, especially in glaucoma. These days, doctors finishing ophthalmology residency don't do a lot of suturing because most of the cataract surgeries that we do is without sutures, and they don't get enough training in procedures that require a lot of suturing. So all of a sudden, they don't have all the tools that a surgeon might need, and you never know what you might need in the middle of surgery. So unfortunately, I don't see that as an advantage. I see that as lack of experience, and they better learn.
Do you ever have to do emergency stuff? I mean, somebody's really had a major injury to the eye, and the emergency room or somebody else calls you in.
Yes, we are on call for our practice, which happens to be a very large practice. We are on call for hospitals, emergency rooms. And yes, sometimes we have to do urgent stuff.
Is that daunting?
No, but it is stressful.
Uh-huh.
Like many things that doctors do these days, is stressful.
Uh-huh. What do we need to know about glaucoma? I don't want you leaving here saying you should have asked me about different stuff. You know, we've got 10 minutes or so. What should we know about glaucoma that we haven't talked about?
Well, we could also use the next 4 hours, but we'll
sure.
try to do it within 10 minutes. The thing that we really need to know, and this is really the message to the community here, is that we as a community, as eye care professionals, and it's not only here, it's everywhere. I'm not suggesting for a second that Albany is different. We are not doing a very good job with glaucoma. We are failing to detect and diagnose. There are terrible numbers if you want to hear. For example, less than 50% of all patients with glaucoma even know they have glaucoma. In other words, more than one of two glaucoma people in this country are not diagnosed and, of course, are not treated, and they don't know about it.
Even though we regularly go to see an eye doctor?
Absolutely, and I gave you examples at the beginning how glaucoma is so easy to miss and how old school thinking is part of it. So we are doing a terrible job in detecting, finding glaucoma. Then there are some amazing numbers. I was just at a conference last weekend at Wills Eye in Philadelphia where I trained in glaucoma. I had a chance to meet all the glaucoma specialists that have trained there for the last 50 years, believe it or not. And we were hearing new numbers and somebody did the research and it appears that less than 6% of all the patients with glaucoma even get good care. 6%. Imagine that out of 100 patients with cancer, only 6% would get treatment for that. This is what it means, because glaucoma is almost behaving like cancer, very quiet, taking your vision away. You don't realize what happens until all of a sudden, oh my God, something is really, really, really wrong.
So how good are you, Asher Weiner? In other words, you know, you hang around my hometown in Great Barrington, they say, oh, you got to go down a special surgery and for a back, or you got to go to Boston. Instead, I went to Gloversville and had a wonderful experience. The question is, are we top-notch? Are we top-notch enough, considering the figures you've just given us?
I can only speak to myself.
Sure.
And I'm not trying to imply anything about anybody else. All I can say about us is that we are. And we have people that, including myself, that have trained in the best places, that easily could be somewhere else and chose to come here for various reasons.
Why? Why'd you come here?
For various reasons. I wanted to change the environment where I was living in. I was practicing in Michigan for a long time. And the environment within the practice, the environment in the community, the economy, many, many things did not allow me to practice as well as I could and should. And I made a choice. I knew that people are desperately needing glaucoma here, help in here, in this area. And I decided to come here and then make it a point to make a difference here.
Now, you had done a lot of research previously.
True.
Is that gone now? And are you basically a practitioner as opposed to a research person?
No, absolutely not. I have shifted my research to clinical research. I do a lot of research publications. In fact, this month, our latest paper is out in the Journal of Glaucoma. In fact, one of our patients in our practice, his eye, surgical eye, is on the cover of the journal because I do things a little bit different than others in order to be protective of the eye when I do the surgery. And this is being published on a regular basis, and it even gets to the cover of the journal.
So, you can photograph the eye while you're doing the operation?
Yes, and after. This happens to be photographs that I took of a patient of mine that we took after the surgery in the office. But yeah, you can do that too.
Okay. What else do you want to tell us about glaucoma?
Well, the question is, how do we find those patients that don't know they have glaucoma? This is one task, and all kinds of things, including screening projects, did not do a good job.
Okay. We haven't done a good
job. That's number one.
Okay, but you say, and I'm listening to you right now, and so are a lot of other people.
Yeah.
Thousands of people listening to you right now. You say, hey, listen, you've scared the hell out of everybody, because basically, you know, you say, not only, because a lot of people think, well, I've been to my eye doctor, and he does the pressure test, as you say, the puff test, and I've been told I don't have it. But now you're saying, okay, but you couldn't possibly handle every single person who is out there who wants to know whether they really have glaucoma.
That's absolutely correct. And so what we do, and that's what we are building in our practice, is a model where we have a team of glaucoma. It's not just me, or we have also Dr. Madhuwali, who is a glaucoma surgeon in my practice. So it's not only the two of us. It's the whole team. Other doctors, general ophthalmologists, optometrists that work with us, they all participate in being a team. So somebody could be walking into our practice and wants to be screened for glaucoma.
This is ophthalmic consultants in Albany?
Ophthalmic consultants of the Capital Region,
yeah.
And we have offices in Albany, in Clifton Park, in Skodak, in Troy, and now it's going to be in other places as well, Schenectady, and even Saratoga Springs. So we are really expanding. So you can access our practice from many areas. But the point is that people are so tuned now into finding those people that once you walk into the practice, and that's how it should be in every practice, if you walk in there, you are completely not suspecting that you have any kind of suspicion for glaucoma. But our people are so tuned into looking at the optic nerves, not only the pressures, for example, looking at the risk factors, finding those people that might have glaucoma or really do have glaucoma. And there are many people who are glaucoma suspects and many people who are actually with glaucoma, and they can triage in a way, and they can determine, boy, this patient really needs to see, say, one of our glaucoma specialists. So they are being transferred to us.
But it's still not enough, right, Asher? It's still not enough.
It's still not enough because there are so many people walking around the streets, they are not being detected.
Yeah.
And that's the problem. And I cannot tell you how many times, probably on a daily basis, certainly on a weekly basis, I have a patient sitting in my chair, and they lost a tremendous amount of vision. They didn't even know about it, or maybe they did. And I break the bad news to them, but on the other hand, I give them the hope that now you can get the treatment and save what's left of your vision and not go blind. And they keep telling me every single time. It's like a recording.
Sure.
And they look at me and they say, Doc, how is that possible? Not only that I was seeing somebody for the past 20 years, I was being told time and again that I'm perfectly fine. How can you tell me that now I had something that has been developing for the past 20 years?
So this is a huge crisis.
This is a huge problem, and this is why I'm here, because people need to hear and understand, and we need to stop this. We need to start being much, much better at what we do in detecting and treating glaucoma.
And one thing is to go to you, but we have all these other people out there who can't get to you, who may hear this in Michigan, who may hear this somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, when you and your colleagues, not only here, but, you know, in your meetings, talk about this, there has to be a national effort, doesn't there?
There's got to be a national effort. And there have been all these attempts at screening. Medicare came out with a way to reimburse eye care professionals to do glaucoma screening. And it appears to be not succeeding. In fact, there's some data.
Because they don't know what they're doing.
Well, there are many, many reasons. One of the reasons these days is that the money is not there. And you can't do all these projects. If you want to go to the community and start screening people to find glaucoma and do it free for the patients and just to do that, well, who's going to get all this equipment and all these vans and all these arrangements? It's a tremendous effort. We did it in Michigan, for example, and we were not successful.
Because?
Because the number of patients that can be tested is very small, and that we don't necessarily have the correct equipment to do that. We need donations. We need companies to give us visual field machines to test people. It's not just about the pressure. We talked about it already.
Sure.
So it's very easy not to get the right people to be screened and to miss because you don't have all the right equipment.
Just to be clear about this,
If
you don't catch it, if you don't do something with it, we can't cure it, but we can control it, as I understand it.
Correct.
Eventually, some people are going to go blind.
Absolutely. I see them all the time.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
It's a horrible situation, isn't it? I mean, somebody goes blind.
It is terrible, and it's more even so terrible because it was preventable. And it's really, really wrong if you can detect, find, treat, and prevent blindness, and you see the patient in front of you basically blind or about to go blind. Something went really wrong, and that's what we're trying to change because it has to stop.
Well, Escher Weiner, doctor, I cannot tell you how grateful I am that you've taken this time. I know how busy you are, and I have a feeling after this you're going to get even busier if that's possible. We are out of time. We've been talking with Dr. Escher Weiner, a doctor in private practice at Ophthalmic Consultants of the Capital Region. They're in Troy, Albany, Clifton Park, Skodak, and many other places. You can find out more at www.ophthalmicconsultants.com. Dr. Weiner, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm Alan Chartak.
Well, thank you for having me. I hope the message is out there.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartak, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.